I read the Times article and it talked about a cure, and I thought, a cure? What are they calling a cure?
The impact of HIV, people don't really want to know the science behind it. They're scared of it, but they still don't understand it and they don't want to know about it.
I mean, it took me a long time to talk about it, and I walked around feeling like damaged goods for a long, long time.
There's other things in the relationship that you're defined by than just your positive status.
How can you ever really freely fall in love or have sex because you've got this disease hanging over your head and there is no cure?
Having those conversations and not being then stigmatized as negative is the direction that I would like to move forward in.
So to me, that was big. It was the first thing that popped up on my phone on the Times line. That it caught my eye immediately going, well, something's going on because they're actually writing about it again.
For only the second time known in history, a patient is in long-term remission from HIV. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin today on The Takeaway. The anonymous London patient appears to be infection-free for a year and a half after receiving a bone marrow transplant for cancer. It's been nearly 12 years since the first patient, Timothy Ray Brown, went into remission by the same method. Many people have been calling this week's news evidence of a cure, but others warn that a true cure is a long way off, even if there's a renewed reason for hope. Joining us to discuss this breakthrough and what it means for AIDS research going forward is Dr. Timothy J. Henrich, an AIDS specialist at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Henrich, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what we're describing, the news here, obviously has involved some sort of special treatment for this patient, the anonymous patient in London. What exactly was that treatment? What did the patient have to go through?
The London patient underwent an allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Stem cell transplantation involves receiving relatively high doses of chemotherapy. They then receive donor cells from an uninfected individual that are genetically matched with the recipient. And this individual received this procedure for lymphoma, for cancer. But these cells also happen to have a rare mutation. It's a very rare mutation that rendered these cells inherently resistant to his strain of HIV.
In the conversation around this, there's been the word cure has been batted around quite a bit. Would you call this a cure or the beginnings of a cure?
Well, I think it's a little bit too early to really say this is a cure. And I think it also depends on how you define cure. If you define cure as being able to stop antiretroviral therapy and not have virus rebound in the blood, and not for this individual who is potentially, quote, cured, unquote, to, for example, not transmit virus to others or not experience ongoing damage because of any residual virus that may be left, then I think many people would consider that a type of HIV cure. Now, I think we hope that this individual will achieve that state, but I think that over the next year or two, there's a very small chance that virus could rebound in his blood. I feel that those chances are small, but they're certainly there. And I think that everyone is waiting, but also waiting optimistically as well as cautiously.
Can this treatment that we're experiencing be mass produced?
Unfortunately, no, not yet. Stem cell transplantation is fraught with risk. There's an increased risk of death, for example, increased risk of infection, increased risk of many other morbidities or problems that can come from the transplant itself. It's not scalable. This is not something that we can do or give to individuals who don't need a stem cell transplant at this time, unless they have cancer or another serious or terminal illness that would otherwise require this therapy.
And tell us a little bit about, there are tens of millions of people living with HIV. What are some of the existing methods for managing the disease? We're in this segment, we're talking also to people who have been living with the disease for more than 30 years and for people who are recently have been diagnosed. So we're hearing about things like PrEP and PEP. Can you tell us what those are?
PrEP and PEP refer to pre-exposure prophylaxis and post-exposure prophylaxis. The antiretroviral therapy that we use for treatment can also be used to prevent the acquisition of infection.
Also, I'm wondering about the state of HIV/AIDS research going forward. We hear a lot about cancer research and the moonshot. Is this something that can inspire more research going forward? Is there enough funding for the types of research that will be needed to do the things that we're talking about, make these cures or make these treatments, should I say, more accessible and find better treatments?
Well, to answer the first part of your question, absolutely, yes. I think we're very optimistic. Granted, right now, it's in a very, very small subset of individuals, in fact, two, that we can now say have undergone this process. But it certainly has led to an enormous amount of interest into trying to find an HIV cure that is scalable. But at the same time, as you mentioned, there are certainly issues with access. If we're thinking about curative strategies and how to implement these on a larger, more equitable scale, it's going to be very difficult, and it's going to take quite a bit of funding, especially in the early years, in order to make this happen.
Dr. Timothy J. Henrich is an AIDS specialist at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Henrich, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Just a note, this next conversation contains discussions about sex.
I am David Gable, and I work here at WNYC Radio. I am 61, and I have been HIV positive a little more than 30 years.
I am Michael. I'm a chef in New York City, and I've been positive for 2 years. I am 30.
I asked David and Michael for their reaction to the news that a cure for HIV could be on the horizon.
It's good news. There's no question. It's hopeful news. I take it with a little bit of thought that this is a ways off. I read the Times article and it talked about a cure, and I thought, a cure? What are they calling a cure?
Right.
Long remission, that's good. But I've got to temper it. It makes me sound ungrateful. I'm deeply grateful. The fact that we're even talking about it at this point, but the fact that it is not going to change my daily life, but I'm really hoping that it stirs more research and it gives a ray of hope to people who are newly diagnosed, because for me, we didn't know what it was. It's like, what is going on? And then why are people dying? And why? And the doctors were trying to figure it out at the same time.
Michael, when you heard this news, what was your reaction to it?
My reaction was hopeful as well. And I tried to basically have the conversation with my friends that understanding being positive now is, I know, radically different than being positive 30 years ago, but trying to understand that the cure, like you said, is way down the road. It's not going to change my daily life. Trying to be in a position to still try to change your day-to-day life is...
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
Let's talk about the day-to-day lives, because I feel like when these headlines come out, we hear possible cure and people are really excited. But what is it like? I want to hear from both of you. Michael, what does your day-to-day look like when it comes to managing HIV?
To be honest, these days it's easier because all you have to do is take a pill. You take one pill and that's it. But for the most part, you just go on as normal. The complications are not even close to what they used to be. And I feel like my generation, people don't really want to know the science behind it. They're scared of it, but they still don't understand it, and they don't want to know about it. They just know that they have either to be on PrEP or to be on a pill if you're positive, and that's all you have to worry about. Just taking pills and not understanding the science, and it frustrates me that the day-to-day that people don't, the younger generation, they're just so scared of it that they don't want to do the research to understand it.
David, let's talk about your day-to-day, because you've been living with this for 30-some-odd years.
Mm-hmm.
What's that been? How has it changed?
Oh, wait, the minute you said, I take one pill, I went, wow, that's really good. I now take two for HIV.
Mm-hmm.
But when it began, I would check with my friends. I was taking like 22 pills a day.
The cocktails, right.
Yeah, and versions of it, and then they changed, and then they changed again, and I am on some other pills that are for the side effects of long-term medication, which adds to the handful. And then I'm on a few things because I'm old.
Of course.
older.
Older. But I was really curious when you when you said your friends don't want to talk about it.
No.
I find that really interesting.
And I don't know why.
Why is it? Is it because, again, the fear that I remember, and I'm a straight woman, right, who was a teenager when this happened, you know, early 1990s, I knew people who had been infected. I knew people who died. This was terrifying for a lot of us. Is there still that fear of being infected? Is there still that fear, still fear of being passing it on?
Yeah, there's still the fear of being infected, but passing it on, at least the community that I'm in, it's like the ignorance is bliss motto. They don't want to know about it. And the people that are positive are the healthier of the entire community because they're positive and they're taking a pill and they're trying to take care of themselves, as opposed to the circuit boys and party boys that are just running around. They're the ones that are positive that are infecting everyone. And that's a huge issue because they don't know the science. They don't want to know the science.
Hmm.
That's the issue behind the younger 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds that, you know, they're not worried about it because they know that down the road there can be a cure, there can be a vaccination, there can be all these different things. They know that all they'll have to do is either take PrEP or take a pill, or even if they are on PrEP, they don't have to use protection because they can literally use a penicillin shot or get PEP the next day if they have any exposure at all and just wipe it out. And that type of ignorance is very frustrating for my community.
Wow. And we were not better because we had come off this sexual, like, woohoo, we can have sex finally. And nobody wanted to stop having sex. I mean, Larry Kramer and the other people who were seeing further down the road said, you've got to stop. So we were no better in the fact that we didn't want to, but we did want to know what was going on.
Right.
That's really, ooh.
Is the media doing a good job of explaining what this is, communicating the concerns, or should we be doing a better job at that?
I think opening the line of conversation to the younger generation and trying to encourage them to, I guess ignorance sometimes comes from fear. They don't want to know about it because they want to talk about other things that are fun and interesting and just part of like a conversation that they want to talk about Drag Race. That's actually like fun to talk about, not something that is potentially devastating that could change your entire life.
But do you think they talk to their doctor about it?
I don't think they even want to go to their doctor and talk about it because of the fact that A, most people can't even go to a doctor because they're not on healthcare, and that opens another door to another conversation. But I feel like the only people they can talk to are their friends or an outreach group. But even then, they just don't want to.
We did send out a question to our listeners, and I want to play something and get your reaction.
Hi, this is Amber Vincent in Portland, Oregon. As a Gen Xer who grew up inhibited by the fear of HIV/AIDS, I was hit by a surprising wave of relief when I saw the news about a possible cure. I didn't even realize I was still holding on to some of the anxiety from my youth. For people my age, the disease stole some of our freedom. Our sexuality developed in a shadow of sickness and death. I lost a childhood friend when he was only 13 because of a blood transfusion. After that, the fear was ever present.
David, you lived through this explosion of the AIDS-HIV epidemic in New York. What's your reaction when you hear Amber's call?
I had to learn about the whole group of people who were coming of age with knowledge of HIV, and that is hovering over your head like a black cloud. So I feel for her because that whole group of people who had to come into their sexuality with the knowledge of this plague that existed, they could talk about it, they could define it, they knew what it was, would be wildly scary. I can't even imagine. I don't know what it was like to test positive 2 years ago.
A lot easier than that.
Okay.
Because you didn't grow up with the cloud over you, did you?
No, I grew up with knowing about it and hearing about it, but I didn't grow up with a cloud. But it was still a thing. Like when I came out, my parents were like, oh, well, like they were very accepting and very loving, but they were like, you have to be careful. And they were like driving home the point, like, because my entire family are doctors, they're driving home the point of like, you have to be careful and you have to be this and you have to be that just for the status that they thought would kill me instantaneously. And this was back in 2004, not even the 80s, because of the culture that they grew up with in being doctors and hearing about that.
When you found out that you were HIV positive, what conversations did you have to have with your family, with your friends? Like, is it something that you're...
I still haven't told my family.
You still haven't told them?
Mm-hmm. No, 2 years later, I still haven't. And I had the conversation with my boyfriend, and his immediate reaction was, I don't know if I can be with someone that is positive. And then he was diagnosed positive a month later, and then everything just shut down and fell apart. And it was very difficult, but I still remember, like, 2 years before that, we were open for a couple of years, and he got to the point to where he was talking to me about a partner he was going to be with, and he was like, oh, I just don't think I can really hang out with him. And I was like, why? And he was like, oh, because he's positive. And I'm like, if he's positive and undetectable, what does it matter? And he was just like, I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to deal with it. And like, it's just an automatic turnoff to me.
So there is still stigma.
Completely. David, across the board.
David, what does that feel like to you also?
Well, first, I'm so sorry to hear what I'm hearing, but it is what it is. And your parents are doctors, and still there's a fear to talk about it, which I get. Yeah. I mean, it took me a long time to talk about it, and I walked around feeling like damaged goods for a long, long time.
Still there.
And people didn't want to know whether I was positive. I was the weirdo who would say it up front because no one asked. We were supposed to ask each other, and no one did. So I'd say, and I remember someone getting really mad at me, going, well, why did you even flirt with me? I'm like, well, I'm the good guy here. I'm telling you up front so that we can be careful. Mm-hmm. And the stigma breaks my heart, and I still don't get it. And then we're talking in this room like you and I are like good, healthy white boys. You know, that's a – and think about if you're not or you aren't – you don't have access to medication. I mean, then the stigma adds up to you even further, and you can't talk about it. I deliberately at work here came out about my HIV status. Not like I announced it on purpose, but I thought I'm not going to not talk about it. And I was amazed when I did. Fortunately, I work with curious, wonderful journalists who had questions about it. But I also discovered they hadn't actually met someone who was HIV positive that they knew about.
Right.
And so I went, okay, this is important. I need to let people know, because people who are 20 need to know that here I am alive and well and managing and informed as best I can be, not being a doctor. But the stigma baffles me a little bit. And I think you got to come back to the fact of lots of people still think being gay is a terrible, terrible thing. And I don't know if that's the root of it. I don't know.
Michael, what do you feel needs to happen so that this conversation shifts from, because it's already shifted, right? We've seen some shifts in, we mentioned PrEP and medication, but if we're talking here in 2019 about this stigma, about the fear, about the feeling that you're somehow less than, something needs to change. What do you think that is? Is it media? Is it the medical field? What is it?
Honestly, I think that the biggest push forward is the conversation about just healthcare and access to all of that, so we can move forward and not have to worry about copays and Medicare and trying to have access to it, because at the end of the day, that's what people's biggest fear is. If I get this, can I afford to survive for the next 50 years? Can I, like, not even the cure or vaccination, just if this happens to me, will I be okay?
I agree. I think talking about now, here's how you live with it, here's how you can live with it, we need to talk about it, is for, like, at least the two of us, possibly more important than, oh, there's a potential cure down the road. And what doesn't get talked about is every day living with it, maintaining it, being okay with it, and not hiding it.
Do we need more activism about this? I'm thinking back to the early 90s when those of us who just felt completely helpless said, okay, whatever we can do, we'll do. We'll phone bank, we'll march, we'll do whatever we can to bring attention to it, to get funds for research. It seems like we're there, but do we need to continue that level of activism to get to the place that we need to get to? Like, has this disease or has HIV AIDS become something that is somehow normalized and we're not understanding the severity of it and the stigma that comes with it because of that lack of activism?
Yeah, it's a disease you can manage. But if I would go off my medication, I would eventually die.
Right.
There's no question. What the activism I think we need, Tanzina, is two people talking. We lost about 10 years of research in the beginning in the 80s, in the Reagan years, because nothing was done. And I am impressed and grateful that it has sped up and that there are scientists and doctors who are pushing forward with it. But the group of people like us here in this room, that is a group of people that is sort of forgotten about. Like, oh yeah, you're living with it. You're doing this every day.
Is there something that makes you hopeful, Michael, about this, about the news, about the status of where we are today with HIV?
I'm hopeful in the fact that, yes, there could be a cure in the future. But again, that is so many years down the road. I'm hopeful in the fact that I do have some people that I talk to that are trying to educate themselves, but it's still not enough. Having the activism to just not talk about it in small groups of two and three, actually talking about it at nightclubs or on Drag Race, where it's millions of people that can see this, having those conversations and not being then stigmatized as negative is the direction that I would like to move forward in, because it's no longer a death sentence and there are pills for it. Just talking about it and being okay with bringing up talking about it, and not as soon as you talk about it, like you said, someone getting angry and be like, why are you talking about this?
What makes you hopeful, David?
I'm extremely hopeful that I think a cure is down the road. That's amazing to me. And I have to put that into perspective. I am hopeful that we are here talking about it. I am hopeful that it hit the newspaper. I am hopeful that we will continue little by little to sort of learn the lessons along the way, because I don't believe anyone ever in the 80s deserved AIDS the way people were accusing us. But I believe we have a responsibility of behavior, of information, I mean, an individual responsibility. And if that can grow at this point with younger people, people in the middle, people older sharing their information, the fact that we're talking right here, because I know a whole bunch of guys 60 and up who live through it and can talk about it. But we often talk about it in the same room as guys 60 and up. I wish we could somehow bring this moment together more often.
Me too.
Or with families, or with people who are afraid to ask questions. I think there are people who want to know more, and no one is really opening the door to talk about it.
Or having the platform to connect all the groups.
I just want to say this was a really wonderful, robust conversation. I want to thank you both so much for sharing what can be very emotional stories. And thank you. David Gable is an administrative assistant for WNYC Studios, and Michael is a chef in New York City. Thank you both for being with me and having this conversation.
Thank you.
And you can hear more of David's experience on the Nancy podcast from WNYC Studios. Just head to wnycstudios.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.